everybody. This is Armand DeMille with you at The Positive Mind here on WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial, bringing you ideas, concepts, and guests to help you lead a more positively minded life. And I tell you how good things come in strange packages. The other day I got a call from an old friend who said she's having a guest on her program, and she said be sure to listen. And it turns out the guest is one of my dearest, oldest friends who I've had some spent significant time with in my life, a co-professional, Dr. Bernard Starr. Bernie, welcome to WBAI, and what a nice thing.
Yes, isn't it? It's great being with you. It's really like a big homecoming. I mean, not only haven't I seen you for a few years, but I actually went to graduate school right across the street here, so I'm very familiar with this area.
It's great
seeing you.
You went to grad school at Carnegie Hall?
No, down the block there, Yeshiva University. Their graduate school of psychology was right across the street, and I used to trek in from Brooklyn every day, get off the subway there, walk past Carnegie Hall, the Russian Tea Room, and a lot of memories on this block.
Well, Bernie is a psychologist, and he and I worked together for a while, and we were working together on a particular project. Let's have Bernie introduce that to you. Bernie, let's talk about the past first, okay? The intense feeling process, that whole idea, the concept, because then we could show the evolution.
Well, yes, we go back to, this was in the 70s, actually, and there was a lot of discontent at that time with traditional psychology, the fixed session, the formality of the session, and there were very many affective approaches that were beginning to surface.
Affective means?
That focused on feelings, directly getting to feelings.
Affect is a word that means feelings, and affect, when people talk, not effect, but affective feelings, is how do you get directly to the emotions? What if you can't feel it?
Well, exactly, and that was the time when primal therapy was surfacing, and boy, they did it in spades, and we were very impressed with that, and we wanted to explore all of the feeling therapy, so we set up our institute at the time, which you became president of, the Institute for the Dynamic Affective Psychotherapies. That's kind of a mouthful.
What a mouthful, huh?
It was. But it kind of, the dynamic referred to the traditional therapies, the Freudian dynamic therapies, and the feeling therapies. So we wanted to encompass it all. And we brought together some of the leading people.
Amazing people, right? David Freundlich.
Freundlich, Martin Kassan, Alana Rubinfeld. And we used to meet up in your penthouse there.
And we used to have quite a few meetings, and we would explore the stuff. We would explore the stuff about what is the feeling, and how is the feeling, and where does the feeling come from, and how do you get to it, and what's the best way to get to it. So Gestalt therapy was one of the questions. Bioenergetics was another new therapy. And there are a number of new therapies that all kind of led to the idea there must be some way to get a person to feel the feelings that they don't feel, because what's the problem? The problem is intellectualizing feelings. Right. The problem is your mind. You just can't trust your mind.
But the traditional approaches at that time had everybody fearful of going directly to emotions. The Freudian psychoanalytic approach said, you have to just dance around these things.
And how do you dance around them? You talk about them.
Talk about it. You can't break through defenses. The person will fall apart. And so we were quite worried at the beginning, because primal therapy slammed right through the defenses, and we were kind of cautious about that, but we very quickly found out that the defenses are not that fragile. You did many demo sessions, and we had many patients where you would cut right through, and there they are writhing on the floor, and they're back, at least in their minds, back in the womb or the single cell state or whatever, and many of them were high-level professionals. And after the session, they would get up, straighten their shirts and ties and go down to Wall Street or whatever. So we found out that the defenses were not that fragile, and there was a lot of mythology about traditional therapy.
I remember Peter Hogan, who was my teacher, said to me once when I saw him working this intense way, which is people, I mean, we're talking about people emoting their feelings, not just talking about, I was angry with him, and I had this feeling, and boo-hoo. No, but going into the feeling, feel that rage, see what that's like, feel that terror, see what that's like. Go into the range of it, go into the edges of it, so therefore you won't be afraid of the middle of it. You see, you won't be afraid of the small amounts of it if you're willing to visit the edges. And so Peter, one time I saw him with working with somebody who was diagnostically psychotic, which means not in touch with reality. And she was in a room doing this screaming and yelling and hitting a pillow. And I said to Peter, I said, Peter, what are you doing here? I was a young psychology student and he was a psychiatrist. And I said, what are you doing, Peter? Aren't you afraid? And he said to me, what are you afraid of, Armand? You're going to drive her sane? Because he made a good point. He said that all feelings, all pathology, all mental disturbance is because of the avoidance of feelings, mm-hmm. the avoidance of them. And he said, therefore, anything you could do to connect people to their feeling self was essential. And therefore, Peter, who was part of our thing, you know, it was another pioneer at looking at this, and which we did. And we did this for a number of years.
Yeah, and it was a very big breakthrough for psychotherapy, for psychology, and I think it even fed back on and transformed the traditional therapies so that even psychoanalysts today practice many of these feeling approaches.
Remember the primal box?
Our famous primal box.
Let's tell the story.
Well, we wanted to set up a primal institute, I guess, or a center, and we rented office, fantastic office space. Was it on 72nd
79th.
Or 79th? And it was a five-room apartment, street-level entrance, lobby.
Doctor's
entrance,
office, classic,
big,
right?
Big thing. There. And I don't know if I should say this because it will give away the time frame of this. I think it was $600 a month for the rent.
Which was a lot of money for us.
So we needed to insulate the place, and we brought over, we had a primal box. I think you had purchased.
First thing we did was we insulated every inch of the place with the regular insulation. Then we got this box, which was a box that you put inside the room that you is so padded and it's so so strong that you just couldn't hear a peep outside of it.
Right. And that day that we were going to test it out, I brought two kids, my son Jason and another child, an interesting story, Richie Bernstein. And we went upstairs to the apartment above the office, and we had them screaming in the primal box, and it was coming up right through the walls.
It was an old building
on 79th Street, and we realized there was no way you could insulate
that. But now we have, you know, the place I have here is insulated perfectly, and it's our space. You know, it's our space, which makes a difference. So now I want to take to the evolution, because there is a very important thing here. You see, feelings are very important as part of the path of mental well-being. I'm not going to say health, but your mind has got to be free. Number one, you can't be a compulsive thinker, because if you're a compulsive thinker, you shut off your heart and your mind takes over. You can't be just a plain old compulsive person who acts out everything, because you act it out and you still don't feel anything. If you get angry and you hit people or you scream all the time, it's also not working. Some way you've got to be willing to go through and experience what the feelings are. And that's, I believe, step one of the feeling of the therapy process.
Yeah, well, I think that you have to experience everything. And I think that that's what we accomplished with the primal approach and these other affective approaches. But then, even there, I think ultimately we discovered that it wasn't enough, that there was something missing. And I think that this is where what I call spiritual psychology comes in, that all of these approaches, be it primal or psychoanalytic and all the derivative theories from psychoanalysis, they all are based on defining who we are by our experiences. You know, and there's different takes on that. But, I mean, essentially, that's the main item, that we are our experiences.
What do you mean, our experiences?
Well, we can...
You mean, if I go to the bathroom, I am a person... That's an experience. What do you mean by...
Well, we're born as kind of a blank slate, and then people tell us, you know, who we are and what our abilities are, and then we have experiences. Our parents are loving or they're rejecting, and
et cetera,
and we start building
so
up.
So we are our history, or the experience that we've had, and that's how we define
it. Right,
ourselves.
And we're feeling people, and we're also thinking people, and psychoanalysis and other therapies tended to just concentrate on the thinking part. Then the feeling part came in, and there was the belief, well, if you can live through these feelings, if you have this great catharsis and the screaming and whatnot, and those were very real experiences. People were connecting with things that were either suppressed or that they were frightened of in their lives. But basically, the approach was, and still is in a lot of traditional therapy, that we go into our past and we analyze and look at and explore all our experiences, whether it be intellectually or emotionally or both, to find out who we are, you know. So when we're writhing on the floor and we're experiencing mommy and daddy and all of the traumas that we experience, we believe we were finding out, oh, that's who I am. I'm that frightened child. But that's only if you're locked in at the ego level. When you go to another level, which we could call spiritual psychology or a transcendent consciousness or another consciousness, what I call in my book omni-consciousness, just to introduce a new neutral term.
Okay, but wait, go back.
We're something more than our experiences, in other words.
Ego level, when you say that's on an ego level, meaning
me, what? Me. The me of my experiences.
Right, which is what's wrong with the me of my experiences. First, I'm trying to find out who I am, so I got to go to
well,
the
me. Well, that's one take on who
I mean,
you
really,
are.
The question should be not who am I, but who are we? Is that what you're saying? That spirituality is a much bigger question than who am I? It's like, what is this bigger thing?
Well, the question is more of, you know, who am I? You could extend it to who
but
are we.
That's
but in other words, am I, Bernie Starr, only my experiences? Or are those experiences just happenstance things that happened to me by virtue of the conditions of my birth, the experiences that I had, et cetera, and then I define myself, that's who I am. And, you know, I'm kind of locked into that. And I think that that's where these feelings eventually come, where people feel, gee, I'm more than this, and I want to get outside of that. And I want to transcend that. I'm more than the ways in which I've defined myself. But then we find that we're kind of locked into it, that the minute we get away from those things, we feel it's the not me. And it kind of frightens us. And then we go into some other experiences like meditation, and we discover that there's another dimension to consciousness, something that preceded the definition of who I am by virtue of my experiences, and that consciousness could be very liberating. And it's not that we need to reject this other part, the me of my experiences, you know, Bernie Starr or Armand DeMille, and, you know, who you are as a person functioning in this world. Because there are spiritual traditions that try to reject that. You know, what Andrew Cohn calls the let's get the heck out of here philosophy.
I don't know what that is. Could you tell me
about that? Yeah, well, that means that we want to get away from, you know, who we are in this material, everyday world, the me of...
And we use spirituality as an escape.
And then it becomes an escape, that we have to get rid of that, and we have to go into this transcendent woo-woo state of, you know, of some kind. And so I think that that becomes a distortion.
But how about a valid criticism in that there are people... Your book, by the way, is called Escape from Your Own Prison, written by Bernard Starr. He's been an author of quite a few books in. And Bernie is... if I were to give you his qualifications, we'd probably all fall asleep just hearing him. The number of credentials he's got. But he's a good guy. And Bernie, Escape Your Own Prison. In Escape Your Own Prison, we're saying somehow we feel trapped frequently, and we feel trapped even when we find our emotional self. When we connect to our emotional self, there are some people who are always connected to their emotional self, who are trapped in their emotionality. Do you agree or don't agree?
Yes, absolutely.
What about those?
Well, there's a good reason for that, too.
Go ahead.
Because emotions, particularly powerful emotions, make us feel real, make us feel like this ego isn't this me. this me isn't just some idea, some thought, some concept that I have, that it's real. And what could be more real than your emotions? Because you could, look, I'm angry, or I'm in love, or you know, I'm excited about something, or I'm ecstatic. That really feels like me. And part of developing this me is to make it feel real, because in a certain sense, it's not. In the sense that it's ideas and it's concepts that we have about ourselves, and we have to keep finding ways to reinforce that, to kind of like feel ourselves and say, hey, you know, I really am real. That's why we need a past, a history. You know, we need the sense that we have this history and that we're moving from the past to the present, and we're aimed toward the future.
Slow down a second, Bernie. If you are an overly emotional person, and you're a person who feels a great deal, and at times an overwhelming amount, what is missing specifically? What's the process? That person has to go through behavior modification. They got to go through centering. They got to do something about not believing how big their emotions are. Right? I mean, somehow different than other people who are so repressed, who have to believe their emotions are not as small as they think they are. Is that true? I mean,
but here's the problem.
Yeah.
And part of the problem is the way we talk about ourselves and we talk about emotions. For example, we commonly say, I'm angry, or I am excited, or I am this, I am that. Well, the minute you say, I am that, then it becomes a definitional part of you. Okay, how are you going to get rid of it? If something defines you, it's like cutting off your arm. You're saying, I'm angry, but I want to get rid of the anger. Well, but if that defines you, and you know, and many of us have found out in doing therapy with people, that they'll say things like that. I want to get rid of my anger. I don't like being an angry person. And when they accomplish some of that in therapy, some of them begin to feel lost. They say, hey, you know, that's not me. You know, I want that anger back because it feels strange. You know, I'm lost. So we have to change our way of thinking about that. Is it that I am angry, or is it that I am experiencing anger? Now, there's a big difference there. If I am experiencing anger, the anger is there, I'm here, there's a space in between. Okay? And if we could recognize that space, then it gives us a choice. Then I'm not angry, I'm just experiencing something. And that gives an entirely different perspective on it. And from my point of view, that's what I call spiritual psychology. My approach is not a deist approach. It has to do with a psychology of consciousness, that there's this, what we call the me or the ego consciousness, and there's this other consciousness. And we can look
Let's talk about the other consciousness then. Because here we have the two, I'm going to use the two extremes, the over-emotional person, who you're suggesting has to put a distance between themselves and their over-emotionality in some way, so that they can't really believe that they are their emotion. They can't keep validating it, because they do, and it means I am angry, I am upset, I am, you know, the victim. Mm-hmm. That's one. When you take some step away from that, you say, no, I'm experiencing this, I am. Now, when you introduce spirituality, which is kind of an interesting thing, because I've known the most effective...
And again, spirituality as consciousness.
As consciousness. And consciousness includes a bigger question then. If I am not my experience, if I am not my passion, if I am not my addiction or my emotion, then what am I? And there begets a difficulty, because
yes, that's the big question.
As soon as you say I am, you're back to the old ego me.
You put your finger on the essential problem in spiritual psychology, and that is this idea that the only valid me is this very personal me, and that if there is indeed some impersonal consciousness, which many people can experience in meditation, people begin to feel lost, because we are so conditioned to think of ourselves as this concept that we developed from birth onward of who we are. And a lot of it is not easy to shake. And the fact is that we're both. That we're both. The liberating factor here is that if you could experience this other consciousness, this, and it's a lousy word, impersonal, because, you know, it sounds like unfeeling, uncaring. That's not what it means at all. But if you could experience this, what is referred to as this kind of timeless open space or emptiness, as it's called in Buddhism and other traditions, that you could then see that this personal self is just one manifestation of that consciousness, okay? And that you don't have to get rid of it. And I think that that's one of the differences between some of the Western approaches, and certainly one that I embrace, and some of the Eastern ones that we condemn the ego. Let's get rid of it. It's no good. Let's kill it. The fact is, we need our egos, and we need this personal me for functioning in the world. And we've spent much of our early development focusing on that, and it's inevitable. I mean, you couldn't function in the world without it. So it's not either or, but that if we, essentially what I'm saying is that in spiritual psychology, what we try to do is to reverse figure and ground. That for most of us, the me self, or what we're calling the ego, is the only me, and that's going to get into trouble. And we could talk about that, because the ego, it has many limitations to it. And if that's your only default setting and your only operational system, you're going to be in trouble at some point. And that's when people get on the spiritual path. Oh, I want this other, yes, this other consciousness sounds great. But what we need to do is to embrace both, but to lodge ourselves in what I'm calling omni-consciousness, and seeing the personal self or the ego self as one manifestation of that. And when we do, it gives you much more flexibility, because your ego or the me self is not a threat anymore. You don't have to fight it. You don't have to destroy it. You don't have to change it necessarily.
Okay, well, let's just take a minute here, since we're talking about consciousness. Is that the we? Is that the I am not connected to me? I am a part of everything around me? Is that the part we're talking about? We're talking about a kind of a universal consciousness?
Well, that's one concept there. It's a very difficult one.
Well, many the one you're talking about.
Yeah, and many of the spiritual traditions will say that.
Is it the Jewish one? Is it the Catholic one?
It's one that permeates, I think, all of the spiritual traditions.
Which is basically what?
It's the principle all is one, that essentially everything in the universe is, sounds very abstract, fancy wording, and some people would consider it that kind of tricky spiritual kind of talk, like the hand, the sound of one hand clapping. I mean, what
it's
is
like
it?
A Frankfurter. I'll have one with everything.
Right.
Give me one with everything.
I'm one with everything. That pretty much is the philosophy of Buddhism. I'm one with everything. So the spiritual traditions will say that when you get into this state of, call it omni-consciousness, Buddha consciousness, whatever, that there is that you can't find that I that we always talk about as me. Try to find it. You know, who is the I that is angry, that is mad? And when you, whatever you identify, you constantly find that there's something observing that I, that me. So there must be something before it, okay? And eventually you realize that there is a kind of observing consciousness, an awareness consciousness that really has no shape, no form. And that essentially is the spiritual consciousness. Now, is that universal? When I'm having this conversation with you today, Aman, am I really talking to myself? You know, we really, one difficult concept to grasp, but that notion has even been validated by science in terms of everything in the universe being connected. Now, again, that sounds very intellectual and distant from...
Let's not discredit it too much, because we're in the same neighborhood here. When I talk to you, Bernie, I am talking to myself. And when you talk to me, you are talking to yourself. Because, and whatever self is, you know, we are part of the same thing. Now, when you're aware of that, when a person is aware of how big the universe is and how big they are part of, or what they are part of, everything else does seem kind of small. But some people use that as an escape from dealing with the small. See, some
well, absolutely,
people use
absolutely.
This. I'll go to universal consciousness, and therefore I don't have to.
Oh yeah, no, you're perfectly right. In fact, I've recently been thinking about and identifying three types of approaches to spirituality.
Tell me.
One is the purely intellectual one. You know, where it's just an intellectual discipline. I've attended a lot of conferences over at Columbia University in the Buddhist Studies Department, the Philosophy Department, and many of these people, they don't practice anything, but they just, you know, talk about it, and they're trying to find out what really is emptiness. Is emptiness really empty? Does emptiness have substance? And the one lecture, they conclude, we don't know what it is. Okay,
so and if we call it empty, it's no longer empty.
Right,
right. I understand.
So that's one approach, and they make careers out of that, talking about it. Then you have another group that I would call the spiritual lifestyle, and I think that that's what you're talking about here, that there are people, they like the spiritual lifestyle, they like to talk about spirituality, they like to have spiritual experiences, they like to meditate, they like to go to spiritual groups, in these groups they feel very open, they're in communion with the world, with oneness, with the cosmos, with the universe, but they can't have a relationship with a single human being.
And they don't. They like cats, but they don't like dogs because dogs bark and
right.
make too much noise.
Exactly. In their interpersonal relationships, they can't get along with anybody, but they love everybody, mm-hmm. the universe. And they have a certain comfort in defining themselves as spiritual. They do all kinds of vegetarians, they're this, they're that. But you can't find anything that is essentially really spiritual in terms of really being able to love everybody, to have relationships, to bring it down from the spiritual and apply it to the real world.
So in other words, a spiritual work becomes an evasion of intimacy and real risk.
Yes, exactly. And that's what I call the spiritual lifestyle. And then there are those that are genuinely on some spiritual quest where they're not rejecting the real world. They have real relationships. They have real intimacies. And at the same time are seeking some broader identity.
Well, let's say,
broader connection.
You know, love being such a confusing thing. Let's say you're somebody who is on the true spiritual path, and I'll say even you brought up some children, and you watch children as they go through adolescence. You know, the last thing in the world they want is a spiritual path. I don't know about your kids, but I imagine at the beginning, you know, when hormones are raging, or you watch somebody you love going into a deeply emotional, fixed, locked-in place, you're not going to tell them what you see because that's not going to get you anywhere. They're going to reject it because they're locked into their emotional place. What happens to you as you watch? Do you watch with a kind of a love and understanding and let them be who they are? What happens? How do you deal with it?
When you're talking about in raising children.
Yeah, raising children or being in love or having a wife.
Raising children is a complicated matter. We like to take
that
responsibility if they turn out well, you know, and we say, oh, because I did all the right things. And if they don't, we blame it on Uncle Charlie, and you know, he or she is taking after Uncle Charlie. That's why my sister Susan always has said, you have to have at least two children so you know it's not your fault.
Well, that's why I'm kind of asking you about it. Because what happens to you, Bernie, when you are conscious? Because this is what the people
It's a great
me.
Question, Armand.
The women who come to see me, they say, look, Armand, I've reached the spiritual consciousness. I can't find a mate. The men out there are stuck in their ego self. It's the I'm in command. I must control. I must do. And where do you, what happens in your mind? Now, I know 90% of the time, my mind dissolves and says, it's okay, you could be caught in that stuff. 10% of the time, I get hooked in.
Mm-hmm.
Do you find that happens?
Well, it happens all the time, and you hear people on the spiritual path talking about that. That is the transformation that they go. I think you're asking two questions.
Sure.
That if you experience some form of transformation, how do you relate to others who are not there? And that's a problem, and I don't think there's any quick or easy answer to that. To the woman who you're referring to, or the women who feel that they've gone to another level and they're looking for something else in men, and they can't find it, well, they've got to find a man who reflects that, unless they're willing to accept many concessions in life, and some people are willing to do that. The other question is, how can we raise children to be more aware? And there, too, a lot of people have facile answers to that, and I'm not sure that it's easy to do.
When we come back, we're going to have to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to talk about how the many different ways even we who try to reach that level of consciousness can be fools when it comes to love itself and relationships. It's such a difficult thing. We'll be back with you in just a couple of minutes. My guest is Dr. Bernard Starr. That's A Fool for Love, by the way, but Chris Stills. A little hangover from yesterday's music I meant to bring you. But my guest in the studio is an old friend, Bernard Starr, who I think is going to be with us a lot more. Bernie and I, we were kind of pioneers in a lot of different places in psychotherapy and psychology, and we tried a lot of different things.
And also, the thing that I always loved...
The thing that I always loved about working with you, Armand, was when we would go out and give demonstrations and talks. I remember... What's popped into my mind just now is something we did. I remember driving out to Long Island somewhere, and whenever I'd reach a dead spot or a stall on something, I knew I could always toss it over to Armand, and you know, he's like the great talker. You put a quarter in, and he starts talking.
Because, well, it was easy to pick up on the stuff you had.
And on the money, though, real talk.
Right on where you are, sure. Sure, because, well, that was easy. We had that working with each other. And Bernie, so I want to go back to this idea about people see, many people don't believe in psychology, and I don't in many cases. I see so many people come to me for consultation, and I could just say this week I said to a man who had been in a history of psychotherapy with women, and he had seen woman therapist after woman therapist after woman therapist since he was a child. And he's a young guy, and he said, so I think I need a new therapist. And I said, Jesus, now you've got too many women therapists telling you you're wrong. You know that old adage, if a man is alone in the woods, is he still wrong? well, you know, and he's got these women therapists telling him he's wrong, and men always have women telling them they're wrong. And they get to a point where I said to him, I said, you know, you just, there's something missing here, and it's not going to be found in psychotherapy, which I happen to believe. So there are times that I believe psychotherapy is a trap, because it's like a kind of place you hang out in, and you get your emotions validated, or you get your illness validated, and back what you said, I am my emotions. I am a feeling person. I am a thinking person. I am a dominant person. And you get to identify yourself that way. And therapists very frequently get you there. They kind of use those same words. So sometimes I think you got to make a break from most therapy, because therapy is kind of doing nothing except perpetuating.
Well, exactly.
Things.
By the way, that's why I have a chapter there called Beyond Counseling, Psychotherapy, and Self-Help.
Well, let's talk about it. What about beyond psychotherapy? Go ahead.
Well, I'm talking about the spiritual consciousness, and if you identify and you think and can feel and experience it as reality, then, as I said before, you have a different take on that ego. I mean, the fact is that our ego is kind of... it's kind of a dream state in a way. It's a concept that we developed about ourselves through our experiences.
Yeah, so people should know, when you say ego,
the Bernie Starr, Armand DeMille, who are you,
and
really?
The I that I go around defining as myself is what you call the ego self.
Right,
the
exactly.
The one that focuses on I am said, I am this. Okay.
And from the spiritual perspective, we would say that's a concept. It's an idea. It exists only in your mind. If you try to find that self, you can't find it. Okay. And if you go into a meditative state, you'll even be more distant from it, and you'll sense yourself as something else, that your essence is quite something else. Okay. From the spiritual perspective, too, they often talk about three states of consciousness, okay, that we have the deep sleep stage, okay, which is kind of like the meditative state. There is no identity in that. And then there's the dreaming state. Okay, and then there's the waking state. And many spiritual teachers will say the waking state is actually just another form of the dream state, in a sense, because it's a waking dream, that everything that we do, our whole concept of ourselves, the me, Bernie, you, Armand, is a thought that we developed. And then once we have defined ourselves that way, we have to keep building on that thought. Okay, person gets dissatisfied with it, has issues, problems, goes into therapy, and wants to change that. Well, if somebody told you about a dream that they had, I mean, you might analyze the dream for in terms of what it might mean, but you wouldn't take it seriously as something that you want to change and you're going to devote your life to now is changing. Well, if the waking dream is more or less of that order, going in there and working on it constantly, in a sense, what you're going to do is develop a better dream.
Oh, wait a minute. This is really hot. Bernie, let's go into this again. The waking dream versus the dreaming dream. You have a dream. I got to get a divorce, right? I got a dream. I had a divorce. And you go to see somebody, and the analyst says, oh, you must want a divorce. Do you remember Catch 22?
Yes.
In Catch 22, Yossarian goes in to see the psychiatrist, and he said, I had a dream about fish. And the doctor says to him, ah, that's a sex dream. And then he goes in the second time, and he says, I had another dream about fish. And he said, ah, that's a sex dream. And then the guy finally goes into his therapist, and he says, ah, I finally had a sex dream. And the psychiatrist says, that's a fish dream. So yes, of course, nobody is going to take the dream, meaning that it predicts a reality you should pursue.
Well, in a sense, who we are, or the problems that we have from the spiritual perspective, would be called a delusion, in a way, that we believe that we have that problem, and the therapist comes along and has many of the same assumptions, really, that the patient has. So that if a patient is telling you, oh, look, I'm unhappy with my husband, my wife, I want to have more sex or less sex, or I want this and I want that, et cetera, et cetera, the therapist often will accept those, and that's why I'm depressed. Okay, because of these factors. And the therapist will often accept that that's a reason for you being depressed, that you have to get what you want, that you need things, that you must have certain things in order to be happy. So what we're going to do now is replace some of these ideas you have about yourself with another idea, which in effect is kind of like another dream. Okay, I used to have these discussions with Albert Ellis all the time, because when I was a consultant for Springer Publishing, he published a lot with us, and we became quite friendly. In fact, Janet Wolfe, his companion for many years, said I was the only person who could sustain a conversation with Albert, and that was easy, because I figured out early on, if you want to sustain a conversation with him, you talk about Albert.
Right.
You know,
right.
You talk about REBT. And as nasty as he was often, he liked when you were challenging.
Right. I remember I did a debate with him once.
You know, too. And he was a tough guy to debate because he had practically a photographic memory. And he, people thought he was just talking off the top of his head. But it wasn't true. And I once said to him, he hated spirituality and religion. I mean, he gave me one of his books that he...
We should say that, to those of you who don't know, this is rational emotive behavior therapy, which is basically change your mind, change the words, change your thinking, and you will change.
Right. Right. But he absolutely hated spirituality and psychology and religion. So when I started moving into this arena, was interested in it, he was very critical of it. And once he gave me a copy of one of his books and wrote a little inscription, for Bernie, and I hope you're not going to get caught up in that spiritual crap, which is the way Albert often talked. But then I would confront him. I said, you know, Albert, I said, you're really the leading Buddhist psychologist. He said, so he was taken aback by this. What do you mean? I said, well, you talk about rationality. And the rational self is going to correct this self, because he said we have problems because we disturb ourselves, we screw ourselves up. So I said, well, you know, who is this self that's going to correct this rational self? I said, if it's really rational, then it's outside of personal experience. Because we know the me and all of our concepts of me, or what we're calling the ego, all roads lead to me, so that all of our thoughts are distorted because they're me thoughts, or as Eckhart Tolle says, there's a me in every thought. Okay, so here you have rationality, Albert, and if it's true rationality, it must be outside of personal experience. And if it's outside of personal experience, then it's transpersonal. And that's what the Buddhists are talking about. I said, so you're the leading Buddhist psychologist. So I thought I had him cornered. at that point. And he thought for a moment, because he took everything seriously. And he said, well, he said, but you're never totally outside of personal experience. So I said, well, if you're not outside of experience, then it's not totally rational. And how is it going to correct everything? Now, quite interestingly, sometime after that, I would like to think that it was because of that conversation that we had, he dropped the term rational.
I know.
And he started talking about functional.
Functional is right.
Okay? And the thing is, call it functional, call it rational. If it's rational, it's transpersonal. And I think that he was, in fact, endorsing, unbeknownst to him because of his dislike of spirituality, he was really endorsing a basic spiritual principle.
So Bernie, people and their spirituality and the psychology. Now, here's what you see. You see, well, okay, you are not the me that you think you are. Your emotionality is kind of almost an evasion of a much bigger self that's available to you.
Yes.
I've been studying chemistry, medicine, and physiology, neurochemistry, and what I see is between neurotransmitters and hormones, almost nobody's experience is what it seems to be, that emotions seem to be dictated by hormones and neurochemicals that are kind of setting it off, and you drop the dopamine and you put up the serotonin, and if you move it around, the person will have a predictable emotion, and it'll be a predictable self. You give me a wired, nervous, crying self, I'll say, I bet their serotonin's not there, and I'll be right. So now we have another dimension that we could also go to, and we could basically say, you, the emotional self who is possessed by yourself or by your thinking self, you're just not you. And Bernie and I know it. And the chemists know it. And the neuroscientists know it now. And maybe not only are you not you, but we're not we. We're not what we think we are.
Yeah, exactly. I think you're putting your finger on something that's extremely important here, and I think it also identifies another shortcoming of the spiritual traditions and the spiritual paths, which don't recognize a lot of things, because many of these traditions arose pre-science, pre-psychology, pre-neuroscience. So these things are left out. And it's an important question. Well, how do these things figure in there? Now, one answer is that if you can get into the spiritual consciousness where you're the observer of these things happening to you. So, yes, we have individual differences in terms of hormones and things that are setting off our autonomic nervous system. But do we, at one level, at the me ego level that we were talking about, we would begin to define ourselves by those things. So, you know, I'm a hypersensitive person. And how did you reach that conclusion? Well, you feel that because you're hypersensitive all the time. At another level, it's because of these hormones, adrenaline and other things, and pituitary hormones and whatnot, thyroid hormones that are being pumped into your bloodstream. So how do we incorporate all of these things, and how does that relate to the spiritual consciousness? And let me add another dimension, and this brings us back to psychotherapy. And that is the question, if we are the observers of these things happening to us, okay, that if I'm an angry person or I have a conflict or I want this or I'm frustrated in my life, can I just observe that and see that that's not really me and that there's a bigger me and that becomes less threatening? Can we therefore, and again, this is a very essential psychotherapy question, can we just jump over our problems? Regardless of how the extent of those problems, that is the answer. Somebody comes in and says, I'm depressed, or I have this problem, or I'm angry, or I'm suffering. Well, let's meditate now. Let's find this higher consciousness, and then you could see this as the not you, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And you won't take that seriously, and it won't be a problem anymore. In a sense, what that is suggesting is that we could leap over our problems. Okay, very appealing concept to many people because it kind of smacks of escapism. Okay, well, can we really do that? Are all problems the same? you know, what is the difference between somebody who is psychotic, let's say, or somebody who had a god-awful childhood, tortured in different ways, rejected, as to somebody who had much milder negative experiences in their life? Is it one size fits all, and that anybody could just leap over this? Now, many of the spiritual teachers either say or imply that you could do that. Okay, and I wonder, and I can give you an example of that, if you want, at a presentation recently by a spiritual master in which somebody came up and said, how do you deal with suffering, she said. Now, the first thing that occurred to me, if this person was coming into your office, she would never say something like that. She would tell you what she's suffering about. Okay, she just said suffering. He didn't ask her what her suffering was, and immediately said, "Oh, well, you should experience that to the fullest. You should feel it, cry it out, and whatnot, and then understand that that's not you, and let it go." You know, we know as therapists, easy to say, but much more difficult to do. And I thought, "Oh my God!" You know, first of all, what does she mean by suffering? She could mean somebody slighted her, her girlfriend was invited to a party and she wasn't, or she lost a child, or a family was wiped out in a Holocaust or so. Those are quite different experiences, and the assumption that they're all the same and we can jump over them is a very big question for spirituality, I think.
Yeah, I think so, too. You know, Bernie, I think the real question I have for you is the following. In your own life, and I mean me knowing you personally and me really admiring you, a number of times we get challenged beyond our consciousness. There are things that are likely to set those triggers off in my mind. Like if you keep going after me again and again and again and again and blaming me for something, eventually I'm going to react. You know what I mean? I mean, I know my buttons. My buttons are, you just keep pointing the finger at me. Eventually, you keep doing it long enough, I'm going to react, I'm going to get angry. Do you find that there is, no matter how much knowledge you have, sometimes I think it's even a collaboration between people to have this take place. Do you find that all the knowledge in the world doesn't help? That sometimes you just got to say to yourself, I'm not going to be 100% for sure. Have you found that for yourself?
Absolutely. I think you're perfectly right about that. And also, I think what you're saying is there are a lot of things that we don't know. And I think that's a very important thing to realize, that there are things that we don't know. I think that this is one of the difficulties in the discussions between psychology, therapy, spirituality. Each one assumes they have all the answers, and many of these discussions are ships passing in the night.
Is there one thing in romance that you don't know? Is there one thing that you could say, I, Bernie, still don't know, and I'm still learning about? Is there a thing there that's...
Oh, I would say I'm learning about everything. There's hardly anything.
But there's no particular area where you feel that you're still... You know, making that little leap forward that's going to possibly happen, not part of the I, but part of the integration.
Well, it's the integration that I'm puzzled about. That's a bigger discussion of, we could talk about what's wrong with psychology, what's wrong with spirituality, what are the open questions that we have. We like to pretend that we have all the answers. And just what I mentioned to you in the office early about my son becoming a rather well-established, famous noir mystery writer, and you met him once. We went to a Little League game with him years ago. I spent a load of time with him because I taught at the college and we spent afternoons together. My wife had a shop and I thought I knew everything about him. If I had to list 100 things that he might do when he graduated from high school, writing would not be on it.
And writing noir mysteries.
And writing noir mysteries.
That's kind of a funny thing,
it's quite incredible. He's done 10 of them now. One's being made into a movie, and it's that I'm constantly astonished. So now it's almost embarrassing because I'm a psychologist, you know, and people say, oh, there must have been some clues there. I'm not sure. There are the mysteries, and we often don't know the people that we think we're closest to.
This is Armand DeMille, my good friend Bernie Starr. honest a man as there is. I kind of like it very much. We are we're coming to the end of our program. Hey, you know, Tony Scott was one of the great jazz musicians, played clarinet, went to the Far East and did a piece of music called The Music for Zen Meditation. I'm going to close by playing you that today, and I'm going to let you know my guest Bernie Stowe is going to be back with us shortly. The book is Escape Your Own Prison. Escape Your Own Prison. I love it. And we will be back with you on Thursday, tomorrow at 1 p.m., my friends. Bye-bye for now. If you want to get a copy of today's show, you can go to thepositivemind.com. Bernie, do you have a website?
Well, I write a weekly column for United Press International, the spirituality and religion section. So if you go to religionandspirituality.com, that's religionandspirituality.com, and if you click on columnists, you could get my last 100 columns.
Great. I think I'll do that, Bernie. Thanks so much. Bernard Starr, S-T-A-R-R. Back with you tomorrow at 1 p.m., my friends.